This time on your weekly constitutional, a very constitutional park.
The Brakes Interstate Park is one of only two interstate parks in the nation, located on the border of Kentucky and Virginia. Pursuant to the U.S. Constitution, it had to be approved by the 83rd Congress of the United States of America.
Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution says that no state shall, without the consent of Congress, enter into any agreement or compact with another state. Who'd have thunk that that meant that Virginia and Kentucky would have to go before Congress to open a park? I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about the brakes.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
We've often noted on this program that the Constitution is not something that necessarily happens in a faraway place. It doesn't have to be in Washington, D.C. or some fancy courtroom in New York City. The Constitution governs all of us, at least here in the United States, and interesting issues can arise just about anywhere. Imagine my surprise when I realized that for the past 20 years, I've been living in close proximity to something called the Brakes Interstate Park, and that park has a very interesting nexus to the Constitution. It starts with a name, an interstate park. Not a state park, not a national park, but an interstate park. Have you ever been to such a place? Well, perhaps, if you've gone to the Palisades Park, which spans New York and New Jersey. But that's the only other one. There are only two such parks in the United States. And part of the reason is that it takes a compact between two states in order to create and administer them. And the Constitution of the United States is very clear that such compacts can only be entered into if Congress approves. We're going to hear from Austin Bradley today. He's the superintendent of the Brakes Interstate Park, and he's going to give us the whole fascinating history of how this park came to be, including the constitutional angle.
Brakes is one of only two interstate parks in the nation. It was formed in 1954 to protect one of the deepest gorges east of the Mississippi River, the Russell Fork Gorge, and just protects an area that adjoins the Jefferson National Forest on the border of Kentucky and Virginia. Just a beautiful example of kind of unspoiled Appalachian territory.
The Grand Canyon of the South, some people call it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely wonderful, fabulous place. But people are going to start scratching their heads and saying, wait a second, is this some sort of nature show we got on here? We thought this was a constitutional show. Why are you on my show?
Well, there's a very interesting constitutional history behind the way that the Brakes Interstate Park Commission came to be, which is sort of the governing body that oversees the operations of the park.
Fabulous. And we will get to that in a minute because it's a really cool issue. But the second reason that you're on right now is that there's a big event coming up, isn't there?
There is. Our friends group, the Friends of Brakes Park, which consists of people from volunteers from both Kentucky and Virginia, have worked together to create a really awesome documentary that chronicles the history of the park and the way it came to be. So we are...
That's going to be aired, right, soon on PBS.
It sure will be, yeah.
In fact, in southwestern Virginia and eastern Tennessee, it's going to be airing in the first week or two of April, right?
That's correct, yes.
Wow. Okay, well, that's extreme. That's, of course, the first week of April 2018. If you're hearing this as a podcast 5 years from now, it'll be a little out of date.
Yeah.
I imagine by then it'll be available online. But
yes.
The first time you hear this in 2018, it's coming up. So that's very exciting. And you and Curtis Mullins, a fellow that I've known for years up in Grundy, have worked together on this along with a whole big crew of other people, and you've won all kinds of awards for this film too, haven't you?
Yes, it was entered in 7 different film festivals, and I think it has won different awards in 4 of those, so it's been very well received. It won the Audience Choice Award at the Push Film Festival close by in Bristol.
Right, and you can see why that is. When you go to the website, what's the website for this film?
It is thebrakesfilm.com.
Thebrakesfilm.com. And another member of the Mullins family, I believe it was Ryan, did the aerial photography for that, which is just stunning.
Yes.
It's just stunning. So, okay, well, that's the reason that I was prompted to speak with you and that I discovered this constitutional aspect. So now that we're oriented, tell us, how does the Constitution enter into the formation of this park?
Well, as you said, the Constitution governs interstate compacts and agreements between states.
Right. Just for you nerds out there, it's Article 1, Section 10, and it says that no state shall, without the consent of Congress, enter into any agreement or compact with another state. That's a very important provision of the Constitution, and basically what it says is we don't want these states acting like nations. We don't want them making treaties with each other unless Congress blesses the arrangement. But that's exactly what confronted the people who wanted to organize this park. The breaks itself, the gorge spans two states.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yes.
So that's the basic reason they needed to do this. Okay, let's take it back to the beginning then, Austin. Who came up with the idea for this park? How did this happen?
Well, so there were earlier attempts to protect the area, the interest to the surrounding the breaks and its preservation goes all the way back to 1869 to a gentleman named Robert Withers, who first gave it its name and expressed his opinion that it needed to be protected.
Who's Robert Withers?
Robert Withers was a doctor. He owned a newspaper in Lynchburg, Virginia. He was a Confederate colonel for the Confederate Army and owned a farm in Lebanon, Virginia, where he went on a fishing trip down the Russell Fork River and discovered the area around the Russell Fork Gorge, gave it the name The Breaks. He was the first one to describe the topography of that area as the Breaks of Pine Mountain. Mm-hmm. And started to express his opinion that the area needed either federal or state protection.
And what year was this?
Was actually 1868.
So right after he finished fighting for the Confederacy, he decided to go on a fishing trip.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess after you fight a Civil War, you need a fishing trip.
Need a little recreation.
And he found himself a gorgeous place.
The natives said that if a deer was run into the breaks, he could never get out, as the walls were so high and steep that they could be scaled at no point, either by man or beast. The whole bed of the river, from cliff to cliff, was filled with rocks from the size of a barrel to that of a house, concealing the water which ran in gurgling streams 20 feet or more below. Senator Robert Enoch Withers.
So he wrote an article and several letters about just the beautiful territory that he had found. And those letters eventually inspired a gentleman named John Fox Jr. He actually holds the distinction as the nation's first author to sell a million copies of one of his books. And Mr. Fox wrote an article called Breaks of the Sandy referring to the Big Sandy River, which is the Russell Fork River is a tributary to the Levisa River, mm-hmm. which combines with the Tug Fork out of West Virginia to form the Big Sandy River.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote, Mr. Fox in 1900 wrote an article for Scribner's Magazine called The Breaks of the Sandy.
And that was a big magazine. I mean, it was like a nationwide magazine.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. So that article described the scenic beauty of the area and the quality of the fishing and the abundant wildlife and all of those aspects. That article circulated around the nation, especially around this region, and a gentleman named Kelly J. Day from Pike County, Kentucky, present-day Pike County, Kentucky, read the article and became very interested in preserving the area. Mr. Day started an attempt to have the area preserved as a national park. He must have been a very persistent gentleman because he didn't start that attempt until 1904, and it wasn't actually until 1939 that the National Park Service came out and did a survey of the area around the park.
The wheels of government spin slowly.
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Then as well as now.
Uh-huh. I understand. Well, that actually brings up a question that maybe we'll address it later, but, you know, why wouldn't this be a national park? I mean, we have the Great Smoky Mountain National Park that spans several states, doesn't it?
Yes.
North Carolina, maybe you'll address that. I'll let you address that when the time comes. But what happened next then?
Well, so the National Park Service came and did a survey of the breaks of Sandy National Park. They were doing a survey at the same time on the opposite end of the Pine Mountain Range, which runs 125 miles from the breaks where we are located, all the way down to Cumberland Gap National Park. Mm-hmm. So both of those parks kind of came before Congress at the same time. And of course, as we all know, Cumberland Gap became a National Historic mm-hmm. Park. The breaks was turned down because of two reasons. Number one, a private company, a railroad, at that time the Clinchfield Railroad, now present-day CSX Railroad, mm-hmm. owned a piece of property, a rail line that basically bisected the park. Mm-hmm. And the National Park Service didn't like that aspect. Also, the roads to the area were just so terrible to make it almost infeasible to do any kind of development even park offices at that time.
You know, so. The funny thing is, I can say this about it, Austin, is that even today,
yes.
for the uninitiated,
yes.
when you're driving those roads,
yes.
You know, and these are paved roads. I mean,
yes.
they're legitimate roads. They're, you know, two-lane. I think they're all two-lane, maybe a few turning lanes here and there. But you're frequently driving about, it seems like about 4 inches, but maybe 15 feet from solid rock walls on one side and a significant drop-off on the other.
Yes.
And it makes a lot of people nervous even today. So I can understand that better now. I can also understand about the railroad, and we'll talk more about George Carter here in a minute. So you got the railroad. That makes it undesirable because you got these steam engines going through and belching smoke and steam in the air and a lot of noise. You got the bad roads, and the National Park Service says thanks, but no thanks.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So of course, all that occurred in the late 30s to early 40s. Your listeners will know that Mr. Day was a very persistent gentleman. This is going back to the gentleman who was inspired by John Fox Jr.'s article,
mm-hmm.
And was really at the front of this grassroots effort to have the area preserved. He was a very persistent gentleman, but around about that time, the nation went through the Great Depression and World War II. So, of course, everything got put on the back burner in terms of parks mm-hmm. and preservation, things like that. So the movement went underground for a while after the rejection by the National Park Service. And then it reemerged for a while in the late 40s to early 50s with an attempt to have the area preserved as part of the National Forest System.
How does a National Forest System differ from the National Park System?
So they're actually technically two different agencies, the National Park Service and the National Forest System actually falls under the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Hmm.
Just completely different management structures, completely different management philosophies.
So parks are for preservation and recreation, and forest is for?
Forest allows some timbering, mm-hmm. Things like that. So it's just a little bit different of a philosophy in terms of the management of those lands.
Okay.
Yeah. And their employees are different. Again, different bureaucracies govern mm-hmm. them. So that effort also fell flat. Some of the landowners around the area got word that the federal government was interested in purchasing their property. So, of course, values or perceived values increased dramatically, mm-hmm. and no arrangement could be made to purchase the land. So that attempt fell through as well until finally Mr. Day, at the kind of the helm of this grassroots effort between citizens of Virginia and Kentucky, came up with the idea of an interstate park, which was actually based on one of the nation's only other interstate park that we're aware of, which is Palisades Interstate Park on the border of New York and New Jersey.
And they had formed their own interstate compact with the approval of Congress.
Yes.
Yeah, and it probably had never occurred to anybody that was an option, because if you look up the various interstate compacts that exist out there, they typically deal with other issues, like, you know, two states that share a harbor.
Yes.
Two states that share a river or a common border, or, you know, there's even an interstate compact on driver's licenses and how people interact from state to state on those things. But only the two. Only one example, Palisades Park. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today my guest is Austin Bradley, the superintendent of a place called the Breaks Interstate Park. Why are we speaking about a park? Well, because the creation of this park required an act of Congress. After the break, we'll speak some more with Austin. Stick around. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're speaking with a fellow named Austin Bradley. He's a superintendent of a place called the Breaks Interstate Park, and it turns out that the Breaks was blessed by an act of Congress. You see, the Breaks spans two states, Virginia and Kentucky, and for years, decades, people had tried to create a national park or maybe even make it part of a national forest or something. All of those attempts failed until someone realized that there could be a compact between Virginia and Kentucky, and that this compact would need to be approved by Congress. Who figured out that that was an option?
Well, really, Mr. Day, it seems, was at the, you know, at the front of this effort. And the coalition that he led, that again consisted of citizens of Virginia and Kentucky, basically pitched this idea to their state legislatures. That pitch happened sometime in 1951. At which point the citizens of both states went to their respective legislators, and then they had to get together as the legislature of Kentucky and the legislature of Virginia, and going back to that article of the Constitution that you just read, they had to ask for permission from the federal government.
Right.
To enter into this compact. That permission was granted. It was asked for in 1952. It was granted in 1953. And then...
So it wasn't that controversial in Congress? I mean, there was no real opposition to it then?
It doesn't seem so. No, we can't find any documentation that there was.
You wouldn't think there would be. I mean, sometimes you get opposition from unexpected sources.
And yes.
If there'd been some, you know, major timbering company or... somebody who wanted to mine it for coal or something, they might have had some influence in Congress. They could have. But apparently this was passed in a year, which by congressional standards is lightning speed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm guessing there was no one who was really opposed to this, though.
Yes, it doesn't seem that there was.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they have this compact. I'm sure you have a copy of it somewhere.
Yep, in my hand right
here. Great. And then they take this and they ask Congress to bless it.
Yes.
And Congress blesses it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you've got an interstate compact between Kentucky and Virginia.
Yes.
Very nice. What does the compact actually do now? How does interstate get governed?
So the compact establishes a body, a very unique body, that is referred to as a joint corporate instrumentality of both the Commonwealth of Kentucky and the Commonwealth of Virginia, called the Breaks Interstate Park Commission.
Before we go any further, you've mentioned that word Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
People sometimes ask me what the difference is between a state and a Commonwealth. My answer is always the same, several letters.
Yes.
I mean,
okay.
It really doesn't make any difference. I mean, there are several states that identify themselves as commonwealths. One of them, of course, is Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is Kentucky. Massachusetts, I think, is another one. And Pennsylvania, I think, is another one. Mm-hmm. But it really doesn't make any difference. Okay, so we got two states, and they're going to form this corporate body.
Yes.
What does this corporate body do?
The compact basically gives it very broad authority to form an interstate park, which would be located along the banks of the Russell Fork River,
mm-hmm.
In Buchanan and Dickinson counties in Virginia and Pike County in Kentucky. It sets in place the kind of the basic structure of the commission. In the beginning, Kentucky had three representatives on the commission, and Virginia had three representatives. That was in 1972, that was actually expanded to four from Virginia and four from Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
But it basically set forth the bylaws of you know, how their meetings and would occur, what would consist of a quorum, that kind of thing, and basically just created this body and gave them the authority to pursue this interstate park compact.
Well, authority is one thing, but mm-hmm. as any government lawyer knows, money is quite another.
Yes.
So it's one thing to say, guys, go ahead and make a park. Okay, with what? So that's my next question. Where's the money come from?
So the money is actually, just like you said, the federal government did not weigh in at all in terms of funding. So the money actually comes from the states. And one thing that the compact did give the commission the power to do is to set fees for various services. Mm-hmm. So if they wanted to charge an entrance fee or if they established lodging, mm-hmm. campgrounds and wanted to charge for that, they were authorized to do so. Then they had to go back to the state legislature, which each state passed its own version, which was identically worded, of the Brakes Interstate Park Compact in 1954. And then each state appropriated a certain amount of money to basically get the effort started.
Okay. So do you get appropriations from each state now as well each year?
We do. The park is funded at about a third of the level of a typical state park, which mm-hmm. is generally a normal state park in Virginia or Kentucky gets about 50% of its budget from taxpayer appropriations. The Brakes gets about 15% when you combine what both states send.
Right.
So we're pretty heavily reliant on the revenue that we generate, but they still do send appropriations each year.
Yeah. And you do a lot with it. I mean, it's not only of great natural beauty, but you've got a lot of other nice facilities there, and you've been adding to them in the last few years, haven't you?
We sure have, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we have, as you know, we're located in the coal fields of Virginia mm-hmm. and Kentucky, which is an area that has really met with some challenges economically over the last couple of decades. So in an effort to allow people to experience just the natural beauty of the area in a new way and to help with economic diversification, we have pursued several adventure tourism-related projects. We have a zip line, a water park. We have a hotel that's perched on the rim of the Russell Fork Gorge.
Chrysanthemum Lodge.
Yeah.
I've never stayed, but I've eaten there a couple of times, and it's got this whole big wall. It's just windows.
Yes. Yep.
And you feel like you're flying through the air as you sit there eating your hot dog or whatever.
Absolutely.
So it's quite an experience.
Yeah. So we're proud of those efforts. We have multiple ways for people to experience mm-hmm. the area. So
and including, I think, if I recall correctly, isn't there something in the center? There's sort of an amphitheater or something where there are performances.
Yes.
So occasionally you'll have performances and other events there. But of course, most people come for the natural beauty. And when we first moved to this region, oh my gosh, 20 years ago, I took my two boys. They were about 10 and 7 at that time, and that's a good time to let kids run around, right? And we went on one of your trails. It's called the Geological Trail.
Yes.
Which has this – every place you look in the park, you can see rock outcroppings, but this is mm-hmm. particularly notable. And so you're going down into these crevices, and you're coming up to these enormous vistas. And, of course, my boys are loving it, and they're running around. And as boys that age will do, they tend to want to get ahead of you. And so I'm constantly saying, boys, come on back now. Don't get out of my sight. But, of course, they do. And then one notable occasion, they run around a corner, and so I sort of hurry a little bit after them so I can get them back into sight. And when I round this corner, they are standing on the edge of what looks to be like a 5,000-foot drop-off down into this rugged territory. Hey, Daddy, look at this.
Yes.
Boys, come back here a little bit, will
slowly.
You? Slowly. Yes. Just, I don't want to alarm them, but I'll tell you what, I have actually had nightmares about that moment a couple of times. So this is definitely a natural park. I mean, you're out there, and though it's safe to do it responsibly, I mean, you could get hurt if you're not careful.
Absolutely. Yeah, we respond. All of our employees do several different jobs. Mm-hmm. One of my jobs at the park is superintendent, and I'm also one of our law enforcement rangers. So anywhere from 7 to 10 times a year on average, we go down into the gorge after someone who underestimated the ruggedness of the topography.
Oh,
there.
Yeah. My, I didn't realize it was that often.
Yeah, it's pretty often, unfortunately.
Well, I'm sure you've had injuries. Have you had any deaths?
We have. Mm. Yep. There is actually a really neat event every year called the Lord of the Fork Race, which mm-hmm. is kind of a triathlon, kayaking, mountain biking, and trail running. But that race is named after a gentleman, John Lord, who's actually featured in the documentary we discussed earlier, mm-hmm. who lost his life by drowning in the Russell Fork River So he was a kayaker, and during October, when the Corps of Engineers upstream from the park release water from John Flanagan Dam, mm-hmm. it really just turns the water in the Russell Fork River into just a class 5 section all the way through the gorge. So mm-hmm. Mr. Lord drowned in the gorge, and we've had various other unfortunate incidents over the years, either people falling or drowning in the river.
Typically. Right. Well, I don't want to scare people off.
Yeah.
It's perfectly
yep.
safe if you do it the right way.
Absolutely.
But you know, this, especially the kayaking, I would think, is really very much adventure tourism.
Yes.
And not for the faint of heart.
Yes.
I've never done it myself. I don't know if I've ever been in a kayak. But class 5 is the most difficult
yes.
level. So
yes.
serious kayakers want to be watching for October. And I think they announce in advance the dates that they're going to typically on weekends. Because they try to coordinate it so that people can go in.
Yes.
Other times of the year, I get the sense that you really can't do much in terms of navigating up and down the Russell Fork because it looks like it's got as many boulders as it has water.
It definitely does. There is a contingent of local whitewater enthusiasts who run it really throughout the year. But just like you said, during the summer, during low flows, it becomes extremely technical, and you're passing through very narrow passageways of water through just house-sized boulders. So, but there are people who run it year-round.
Yep. And one of the neat features about this place that I've noticed on your website is that there's a house there that you get to live in.
Yes, yes.
Tell me honestly, is that why you took the job? Because you wanted to live there all the time?
So that was definitely one of the contributing factors. And I have young children myself who uh-huh. are a little younger than the ages of your sons in the story you told there. So I've constantly, we take hikes, and I constantly have
that.
You want
to put them on a leash is what
yeah,
you want to.
Absolutely.
Give them parachutes or something.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's all really, really fascinating. Let's talk a little bit more about the history. You mentioned George Carter, and he's this guy who had this railroad. How did he play any part in all of this, or was he more or less just sort of the starting point for the denial of the National Park designation?
Well, so Mr. Carter was definitely involved in bringing attention to the region. It was just an extremely inaccessible area. And so Mr. Carter saw the advantage of linking the very rich coal fields in the Commonwealth of Kentucky with the ports and the markets in Virginia.
The Clinchfield occupies the unique position of opening a new gateway, affording a short line between the Ohio Valley, Middle West and North, and the Southeast Atlantic coast, with a coal field in its midst of greater magnitude than that of all Great Britain, which is now producing annually about 250 million tons of coal. George Carter.
His efforts towards establishing the railroad through the gorge definitely opened up just the beauty of the area kind of more to the public eye.
So, okay. So, yeah. In other words, obviously people who live nearby knew about it.
Yes.
But by building a railroad through it, primarily to move coal, if I recall correctly.
That's correct.
He nonetheless allowed people who were on the trains to see that region and spread the word in some
yes.
sense.
He is a tall, spare, quiet-spoken man who has an immense capacity for sustaining labor. And that additional rare quality of setting others to work and keeping them at it until the object sought has been accomplished. He goes straight to the heart of the subject, moves forward where others hesitate, and inspires confidence by the audacity of his enterprises.
It will open new channels of commerce. It will serve some of the most prosperous and progressive peoples of the world and will pass through the midst of manufacturers of every kind. We hope to provide this region with an economic cost of production and distribution, thereby making it one of the busy workshops of the world with commercial facilities second to none. George Carter.
He was a big industrialist. In fact, where we're sitting today, Johnson City, Tennessee, is, I believe, where he lived, wasn't it?
That's correct.
And yeah. he built quite an empire down here, didn't he?
Yes. Yes, yeah. he did.
In fact, Johnson City primarily exists because it was a railroad town.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the railroad that runs through Johnson City is actually the same line that runs through the heart of the Brakes Gorge.
And does it still do that?
It does, yes. The CSX operates trains on that line today.
Just actual steel freight trains.
Primarily steel coal is the number one product being moved on that rail line. Some chemical products, but primarily coal.
Interesting. And are there tourist trains too? Can people take scenic tours on a train, on a passenger train through there?
At this point, no. That has been in the past. There have been a few opportunities to do that.
That would be very nice to have a tourist train.
Yeah,
I bet you'd get some business and more exposure for the park.
So there's actually an effort towards that in Virginia right now. The Virginia legislature established an authority to try to create the opportunity to have tourist trains on the old Clinchfield line. They are running into that same old interstate challenge within the fact that the Clinchfield rail line runs through the heart of the Russell Fork Gorge, the Brakes Gorge. The state line actually bisects the rail line in the middle of the gorge in an extremely inaccessible area with no roads. So in order to actually go all the way through the gorge, you have to cross over into the Commonwealth of Kentucky. So that's one of the many complex factors that they're looking into right now is how can a Virginia authority create tourist trains on a line that crosses over into the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Yeah.
You said once again, you mentioned inaccessibility, and I'm reminded of yet another story. I was out not at the Brakes Park, but I was right nearby for a funeral, I think it was. And as we were there for the funeral, a big storm blew up, and so bad that eventually the lights went out. And of course, you're going to have to postpone the funeral now. And so we all braved the rain. We waited for it to die down a little bit, and then we went to our cars and we started driving out. And then didn't go a mile before everything was backed up because a big tree had come across this narrow two-lane road.
Yes.
And I'm there in my, you know, funeral clothes. I've got a suit on or something like this. And I look at my wife and, you know, it would be hard even to turn the car around, right, at that particular place. And there's a line of cars. And, of course, you're going to have to drive 20 miles or 30 miles out of your way on similar roads before you can get back to the main roads. And we're kind of sitting there looking at each other. What are we going to do now? And then someone just walks past me. And then another person walks past me. And each one of them is carrying a chainsaw.
Mm-hmm.
All these guys had trucks. And all these guys carried chainsaws with them.
Yes.
And 10, 15 minutes later, the cars start moving. And as we go by, they're still there working on this great big old tree. And they're getting firewood.
Yes, absolutely.
It was just such a wonderful thing. It breeds a certain degree of self-reliance.
Yes, yes.
I mean, you're out there by yourself.
Yes.
Okay. And I know it's different now than it was 50 or 100 years ago, but there's still that creed that, you know, I got to be ready.
Yep.
And anything can happen out here.
So that's one of the things that I enjoy most about working at the Brakes is just exactly what you're talking about there, that need to be self-reliant, to be prepared for whatever comes your way. There are areas of our property that take 2.5 hours to reach, and the only way to reach them is with an ATV, a UTV, or on foot.
A UTV, what's that?
Utility vehicle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just a side-by-side as compared to the normal straddle ATV.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we are that same type of person. It just breeds that type of person you were mentioning there, that we carry all of our gear with us. You know, we're constantly, if people get lost, if people get hurt, we have to be ready to respond in a remote environment.
You said you had young kids. How old are your children?
So our oldest is 5, and we have a 4-year-old who was actually born at the park.
Oh,
we're a little distant from hospitals, and my wife went into.
So you're actually having to give birth out at the park?
Absolutely,
man, this is pioneer days. Just,
exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was a very unique situation. I don't think many people still face that today. But my wife went into precipitous labor, and we're located about 45 minutes from the nearest hospital. So that was another example of I actually helped and caught my daughter. And so another example
another
of
adventure.
Kind of being out there. Yeah.
Another
yeah.
adventure yeah. of yeah. being going to the Brakes.
Absolutely.
So everybody, when you're ready to give birth, go out to the Brakes.
No.
And Austin
no.
will help you. I mean, you're qualified now, right?
Yeah, I never want to do that again.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today we're talking about a park the Brakes Interstate Park that had to be created pursuant to an interstate compact between Virginia and Kentucky, which, pursuant to Article 1 of the Constitution, had to be approved by the United States Congress. What a story. After the break, we'll talk some more with Austin Bradley. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Austin Bradley, the superintendent of the Brakes Interstate Park, created pursuant to an act of Congress and a compact between Virginia and Kentucky. He's telling us that this park is so remote that when his wife had a baby, she got stuck there and he had to help with the delivery. And indeed, it turns out that some parts of the park are so remote, you can only get there on foot, via ATV, or perhaps via drone. I'm curious, you're talking about how remote this is. Has drone technology affected how you manage the park? I mean, do you use them? Are you able to launch them and monitor remote areas via high-tech drones?
Yes, we are. Both from the air and also underwater. We have a dam in the park, an impoundment that makes a really very scenic little 18-acre lake in the middle of the park. And in order to just kind of monitor the condition of the dam and some of the pipes that lead through the dam, we actually have an underwater drone that we can use.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And then also in the documentary that we mentioned earlier, drone technology played just an enormous role in getting a lot of the footage. You know, at one time we would have helicopters occasionally fly over and take some pictures of the gorge, things like that. Of course, now we have drone technology where almost anyone can, you know, can become familiar with it and use them. And so we absolutely, the Friends of Brakes Park captured some just beautiful footage of the
Russell Ford
Gorge.
What's the website for that?
It's thebrakesfilm.com.
Brakesfilm.com. And the very first thing you see is a link to a video, the promotional video, and it's just absolutely breathtaking.
Yes.
And again, I think Ryan Mullins did a lot of that aerial photography. Do tourists bring drones there?
They do.
I mean,
they do.
That's more of a thing now, isn't it?
It is, yep. Most public bodies have created regulations that either limit or, you know, completely prohibit drone usage. Virginia State Parks, Kentucky State Parks, also on federal property, I think you're very limited with what you can do. The Brakes Interstate Park Commission, we just haven't had any problems associated with it at this point.
So it's a drone-friendly area.
It's a drone-friendly area, yeah.
I'm reminded of a story I saw recently about drones, which might cause a problem. A young woman was sunbathing in her backyard.
Yes.
You heard the story.
I saw it, yeah. The drone got shot down. Yeah.
That didn't happen around here.
Yeah.
The drone comes over and all of a sudden just starts hovering over I think she was a bikini clad teenage girl.
Yes.
Dad just comes out with a shotgun and just the drone is gone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's some good video.
As a father of daughters, I can kind of understand that reaction. But,
so can I. But I hope nobody comes to your park and starts shooting down each other's drones.
Yeah, we haven't had that situation yet.
Okay, so, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. You mentioned the film again, so let's talk about the genesis of that. Who came up with the idea of doing a film and how did it happen?
Absolutely. So a really neat event kind of sparked the documentary. The Brakes is the site of the only documented quarry for small grindstones in Virginia. And we have a...
You mean like ancient quarry?
Civil War.
Oh, Civil War era quarry, okay.
So they're not millstones, they're grindstones.
What's the difference?
So grindstones are actually smaller and they're used to sharpen tools.
Okay.
Whereas a millstone is used to grind.
Oh, okay.
Grain.
So when you see a picture of some Civil War battle and someone is sharpening his knife or his bayonet or something, it's something he holds in his hand.
Yes.
So it's a special type of rock, I'm guessing.
It is. It is. The sandstone, we have an area in the park called Mill Rock Point. The sandstone in that area is very, very hard and very grainy, so it makes for a good surface.
It's like sandpaper.
Exactly. Uh-huh. It's also deposited in about 12-inch layers that are not very well adhered to one another. So you can
just knock it out.
Yes, and it falls out in big sheets of sandstone that can be formed, chipped away until they form a wheel that can be put on some sort of hand crank or foot crank and used to sharpen tools with.
Right.
So the park, we actually discovered the quarry on February the 18th, of 2003. 14. And we had the state archaeologist for Virginia come out and document the site. And the Friends of Breaks Park, the gentleman you mentioned, Curtis Mullins, became very interested in the quarry and wanted to do an educational video for the park. He brought some Eagle Scout candidates from Troop 740 of Grundy, Virginia out. And they helped kind of document the site. They took footage. It was originally intended just to be a 10 to 15 minute long kind of educational video that mm-hmm. we could play in our visitor center. Mm-hmm. And
you're big in the Boy Scouts.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yes.
So that makes sense as well. Okay,
yes.
So then
yeah.
what happened then?
So it just continued to morph from there. It continued to grow from a 10 to 15 minute educational video to the two Eagle Scout candidates and Mr. Mullins came over to the park and started.
Is that Curtis or Ryan?
That's Curtis.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So they came over to the park and started looking through our archives and felt like that there was a much more compelling story there than just the grindstones. So
this is a Boy Scout Eagle project.
Yes. Yes.
On steroids.
Absolutely. Yes.
So, and I've known Curtis for years and his brother, we met through a wonderful institution over in Grundy called the Mountain Mission School.
Yes.
Which is a school for underprivileged children.
Yes.
And it's a residential school, and both of my boys went to Mountain Mission. They take a few day students as well. My boys were not Boy Scouts, but we knew Boy Scouts. We knew Paul Platt, who was big in the Boy Scouts, and his son,
Jonathan.
Also, John, is
yep.
very big in the Boy Scouts. And so we were very much aware of this, and in fact, all around Grundy, you would see Eagle projects of various types.
Yes.
So this all makes a great deal of sense. But now Curtis is not exactly what you'd call a film director.
No.
At some point, he had to decide, you know, we're going to take this to the next level.
Yes. So Curtis is a senior proposals manager for a healthcare company.
Yeah, seems to have nothing to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But like his father before him, who was also heavily involved in the Boy Scouts,
right.
Curtis Mullins Sr.,
right.
He has a tendency to go big on things.
He sure does.
And so this 15-minute educational film morphed into an hour and 15 minute long feature length documentary.
What was your involvement with it?
So my involvement was to help them with source material, follow up on leads, you know, all these kind of this legend and lore that exists around the park about various stories.
What's your favorite story from the legends and lore of park?
Well, one of them involves George Carter that you mm-hmm. mentioned earlier, the Battle of the Breaks, which was
Okay, I want to hear about this. Tell me about the Battle of the Breaks.
So just as we mentioned, at the turn of the century, it became obvious that the Breaks gets its name from the fact that it is a break in the Pine Mountain Range.
Mm-hmm.
The Pine Mountain Range is the westernmost linear ridge of the Appalachian Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a 125-mile spine of mountain that goes all the way from the Breaks down to Cumberland Gap.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost completely unbroken along its entire length until it reaches us at the Breaks, the Russell Fork Gorge, where the Russell Fork River breaks through it.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, it was the only really feasible route to connect the rich coal fields in eastern Kentucky again with the markets in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So various railroad companies, the C&O Railroad, the Clinchfield Railroad, just various railroad companies realized the strategic potential of that area. And they basically started racing each other in order to lay claim to that area and be the first to construct a line through the Russell Fork Gorge.
In January, the Clinchfield will be ready to do business with your neighbors at Charlotte, Wilmington, and other points in the Carolinas, and will in short time have a train running between the Virginia coal fields and the city of Spartanburg, and we shall not be satisfied until it forms part of a through-line coal-carrying road connecting the Great Lakes, Pittsburgh, Buffalo on the east, Cincinnati, and Chicago on the west, with the Piedmont Cotton Mill District and the smooth seas of the coast of the Carolinas. George Carter.
Was there violence? Is that why they call it the Battle of the Breaks?
So most of the battle was a legal battle. Mm-hmm. They were lots of lawsuits and counter lawsuits, and the most violent thing that I heard of happening that's documented as happening is one of the construction crews basically orienting an explosion so that it threw debris over onto another construction crew.
I hope nobody was hurt. Yeah. But the removal of over 100 years, it's somewhat amusing.
Yes.
But there were high stakes here, and there was lots of money at stake as well.
Yes.
And so George Carter wins the Battle of the Brakes.
Absolutely.
Well, anything else you want to share with us? What are the prospects for the film? Is it going to go national?
So we feel good about the quality of the film. Mm-hmm. It's very well narrated. The visual quality is great. So the PBS stations that have agreed to broadcast the film have been very excited about the quality of it. Excellent, outstanding, or some of the descriptions that we've heard from them. So. Given their reaction to it, we do have some hope that it would be picked up by a network like the Discovery Channel or, a more national network.
Is the Brakes going to get any money if that happens?
So the money, as of right now, the Friends of Brakes Park actually own the film.
Right.
They intend to give the rights over to the Brakes, which they've done us a tremendous favor in that they have they've written a lot of grants. And
that's where the money for the film came from.
Exactly.
Was the grant.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So they want to hand the park a finished product, which we appreciate.
Right.
In terms of money, we just hope that it will expose the area to the greater population of the country, and that people will come check it out and visit. We hope to see an uptick in tourism for sure.
Well, I certainly will give a strong recommendation to anyone listening to make a trip. It's not that far from I-81. It is a couple hours, and it is rugged toward the end there, but it's one of those things, the very ruggedness, how shall I say this, keeps out the riffraff.
That's right.
So the people who are there really want to be there, and I'm guessing that you don't have too many problems with your park visitors.
No, definitely not.
Except those, occasionally fall off of mountainsides.
Or get lost.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Austin Bradley, for coming in and speaking with us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Stuart. It was a pleasure.
And now it's constitutional quiz time, recorded at the We the People competition, the state finals of the great state of Virginia.
You are?
Benjamin.
From? Benjamin.
T.C. Williams.
Oh. T.C. Williams.
Glenn Allen, you take note, T.C. Williams knows how to cheer for itself. Okay, all right.
And are you also a 12th grader?
Yes.
Okay, great. I've got a question for you. How does the Constitution explain the process for expelling an elected member of the U.S. Congress in Article 1, Section 5. So again, how does the Constitution explain the process for expelling an elected member of the U.S. Congress in Article 1, Section 5? Here are your choices. A 2/3 majority of representatives of both houses must approve. B, a mere majority of representatives of the opposite house must approve. C, by following the rules set by the house where the member sits. D, a 2/3 majority of the member's house must approve. And E, both C and D.
Ouch.
Yeah, I got harder this year.
Woo! Last year it was like, what's the court case for judicial review?
I know. I felt like I was too easy last year.
Yeah. All right. You're ready?
Yeah.
You sure? I see some people over here. They're like, no. No. All right. Ben's ready.
I'm going to go with A.
Oh, too bad.
Sorry.
Does anybody else want to try?
Anyone try?
Anybody else?
I think we need the ladies to answer.
Yeah,
yes.
Want some of the girls, not just the boys.
She's like, oh my God, no. We need a lady to answer this question.
Was D 2/3 majority?
A 2/3 majority of the members' house must approve.
Yeah.
Okay, that's part of the answer.
Okay, so.
So it's which one? It's E. D. It's so you have to follow the rules of the house where the member sits, and you have to have 2/3 majority of the member's house must approve. So A, C, and D was the correct answer.
All right. Thank you very much.
That was fine.
All right. Now everyone's scared of the next question.
The next one's kind of easy.
Oh, I notice a lot more hands going up now.
I know. Give me an easy one. Give me an easy one.
Stephanie, I see a lot of hands on the other
here,
side.
Here.
Are you people on the right side? Am I right? Are you all a bunch of cowards?
Where am I going? Here, here.
Yay!
Now, who are you and where are you from?
Nympha Amador Hernandez, and I'm from Aggie Walker.
Okay. And you're a senior?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and you like studying the Constitution?
Yes.
What's your favorite thing about studying the Constitution?
Well, it lets you know the protections and rights that are given to individuals, especially minorities, and how in the Constitution such rights are protected against the rule or the tyranny of the majority.
That's excellent.
Why do you like it, Meg?
I like it because I'm fun at dinner parties.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah. But come on, we know
we know the ultimate reason we study the Constitution is because smart
is
sexy.
Woo!
Okay.
Are you ready for the question? Here we go. How many times is the word democracy mentioned in the Constitution? A, once in the preamble. B, it is not mentioned. C, 7 times in each of the articles. D, once in the Bill of Rights. And E, twice, both in Article 7.
You want to confer?
It's not mentioned in the Constitution.
Ding, 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 ding! Excellent.
Very good.
Yeah.
And there's a very good reason for that, of course.
What is it?
The very good reason is that we are a majoritarian society. That is, that most of the time we make our decisions by voting, and the majority typically rules. However, we're not a pure democracy. There are many buffers, many checks, many balances between the will of the people as expressed in a democratic vote on the one side and the actual actions of government on the other. And of course, this can be problematic at times. People are concerned about things like the Electoral College. They're concerned about other aspects of our democracy, gerrymandering, etc. But on the other hand, the founders, I think it's fair to say, did not want direct general democracy. So we're not a democracy, we're a republic with all of its imperfections and all of its strengths.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Austin Bradley, the superintendent of the Brakes Interstate Park, who told us so much about this fascinating constitutional park that spans 2 states. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. And this week you may have noticed a special guest, a fellow by the name of, oh, that would be me, who voiced over George Carter of Railroad fame. We also heard from Paul Platt and Wanda Beery, whose day jobs keep them at the Mountain Mission School, but who made their acting debuts, their voiceover acting debuts, in this Brakes film. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.